tech we trust. It's the people in charge we're not sure about.
All right then, so it's been 6 months. What are you laughing at? This is episode 26, and by my reckoning, that makes us 6 months old as a podcast. So I reckon a round of applause.
Yay!
Woo! And to mark how special the occasion is, actually, that's a bit harsh, actually, because it's not fair on the other two guys. There's just three of us this week. Myself, Hans the Hulk.
Hey.
And Gabriel, the bringer of background noise. Where is your background noise this week, Gabriel?
I'm actually in my bedroom at my house, so it should be quiet.
Man, that is some good stuff. Well done. So, Hans, I think last week we talked about you going to be MacBook Pro-less for a while. Can you give us a rundown on what's going on with you personally at the moment?
Oh, I did bring the MacBook back. It was on Thursday, so Wednesday I still had it. This time I'm on the iPad recording. Let's see how that works. And after a couple of days, they called me, or actually sent me an email and said, "Well, we could not replicate the issue. So it's the global repair for the graphical card issues on the MacBook Pro, right?" And so I emailed back and I said, "If I'm coming to have to show it to you, ... And like an hour later, they said, "We can't replicate the issue, but we called Apple Global and you can get a new motherboard." So I'll have a new motherboard by the end of the week or maybe by Monday, which is good, which is awesome. And they're also going to replace the top bezel where the battery is in. So I'll get a new battery. I'll have to pay for the battery, but frankly, I'm going to have almost a new laptop.
Why don't they just give you a new laptop?
Yeah, well, so no, it's only a motherboard replacement. Because the graphical card is on the motherboard. The battery was almost dead, which I knew, but and the price was not that bad. It was $230 to replace the with a new battery and the whole top run pack. So it's good. I'm going to have my laptop back. It's going to be practically new. It's almost 3 years old now, the laptop, and it doesn't feel like one day old. And it's the first time I've ever had that. And it's since that I went back to an Apple.
Yeah, I know, but it's bust at the moment. What are you talking about? You can't sing the praises of Apple there. It's bust. They've had like a global recall on it. I thought this whole we build the hardware and we build the software means that crappy stuff like that doesn't happen.
Well, I'm not sure how much it's about. It's probably about the extra graphical card that is in there. There's two graphical cards, the onboard and an extra.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I think the issue is with the extra graphical card. Every vendor has had that issue with one or two of their models. I mean, I've seen it happen more than once on HP PCs.
Please. Don't compare an Apple Mac with an HP PC.
No, I mean, but it's one of the first times I've seen it at Apple.
Yeah, so, fair play. Yeah. So I'm just worried that's me doing the edit tomorrow, then I take it.
No.
Are you going to do it on your iPad?
Oh, yes, you're going to. Yeah. You're going to do the edit of the show, definitely.
You know what, Hans? This is a good segue, actually. That whole Apple Mac thing that you're talking about there sounds like a car crash to me there.
Don't get me started.
Come on, then.
So, yeah. So on Friday, my neighbor comes over and he asks, can you pull out your what I hang behind the car? Trailer, right?
Oh, yeah.
I have a trailer and it's in the driveway between our two houses. He says, "Can you pull it back? We need to be on the back of that shed." I'm like, "Yeah, okay, no problem." So I pull the trailer back and I got stuck with my car in the grass, which is not really an issue. So I call one of my friends and I'm like, "Can you tow me out? I got a bar, like the bar to put between two cars, but I don't have the towing ring." You know, the thing that you screw in the front of your bumper.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And apparently, which I did not know, is that the towing ring of your car is a proprietary thing. every single car has a different one. And
that's ridiculous.
I even think there's different ones in one manufacturer, in one vendor. It is ridiculous. I've had a towing ring from a Mercedes car, from a BMW, from Honda. None of them fitted. Some were left screwed, some were right screwed. It was horrible.
These guys? Have they not got their heads around open standards yet with all this proprietary what? They're living in the 90s.
Exactly. So, but in the end, I didn't really need my car. It's not that I have to drive to work in the morning. So it took me 2 or 3 days to get my car out.
But I've got a project for you there, though. The open car platform. Oh. You need to develop an open standards car.
It's the one ring for car towing.
Yes. Yeah. There you go.
There's probably a startup in there somehow. And I think the towing ring and the picture of the towing ring, somehow it's going to end up in a blog post about proprietary hardware.
Looking forward to it. Gabriel, what have you been up to?
You know, I'm just chilling. for the most part, work has got me kind of at home for the last couple weeks. I got a big a week-long training next week, and I got some trips planned here in the near future. But for the most part, I've been kind of focused on a few things that I'm working on. And, today is actually my birthday.
Hey, so, should we sing for you?
No singing. interesting time to be 430,000 in dog years or whatever it is.
Well, happy birthday, mate. Anyway, I had a guy ping me on Facebook who had followed my recent course that I had published on Pluralsight. Shameful plug, right? Native Docker clustering with Docker Swarm. Go check it out. But anyway, he pings me on Facebook, and so I accept the connection, yeah? And then he actually pings me on Facebook Live Messenger, like last night at about 11:30 at night or something. Hey, boss, how you doing? I'm like, okay, thanks. And he starts talking about, hey, I love your course, all that kind of stuff. And then he says, you've got really cute daughters or really pretty daughters or something. I've got like 3 daughters. They're all under the age of 9.
Creepy.
Yeah, no, hang on, right? Next thing he says, if they were over here, I would have to buy them some candies. I'm like, what? This is like weird. So I'm like, hey, it's pretty late here. I'm calling it a night.
Does over here mean by on like Pedo Island or what?
But I was like, well, that's a bit weird, I think. Anyway, there we go. It is a bit. You're right. Gabriel, one thing as well. I had a failed experiment this week. I tried to Gabrielize my blog. So,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, I really like that theme that you've got. So I went and got it for myself and tried to apply it to my blog, and I lost the I've got a banner up on the top there about Tech Unplugged event later on next month, which actually we'll mention in a second. But it's got it rotates through these funky pictures at the top, and some of my blog posts didn't have pictures associated with them, and I was like, oh, I'm too busy to try and mess with it. But no, I really like the theme of your blog, and I tried to copy you, man, and your shoes are too big. I failed. Anyway, let's move it on a little bit. A lot of chit-chat there. Real quick, Hans, we did a survey. Well, mm-hmm. You did a survey for us this last week. I know I'm personally pretty keen to hear any feedback that you've got. Yeah, go on.
Well, a couple of things. At least we wanted to know, are we doing well? What do we need to change? What do our listeners actually want from us? So first, on the podcast structure, what did come up with request is extra guests would be nice, and the live recordings. I know we're at least going to do a live recording at the VMUG next month, the day after the Tech Unplugged event.
Oh, yeah.
So people liked the live recordings at events that I've already done. Going to try to do a couple more this year. Extra guests would be nice. So maybe we should call in guests when there's events. That'd be a nice idea. And the most requested for the podcast structure is more depth per topic.
Really?
Yeah, I already thought that would be the case, because looking back at what we've done, how the podcast grew into the last couple of weeks, is that we crunch all the news of the whole week into show, and we try to talk about every single topic, which doesn't give us enough time to go into depth per topic. So probably going to look at I really want to bring all the news of the week, but maybe we should like work a little bit on how we bring it, like giving all the news into bullet points and then taking one or two to go in depth.
Maybe, yeah, it might be a good idea.
So
yeah.
That was, so for the positive parts in that, so guests is welcome, definitely more depth. They were not so keen on the C-level talk, and apparently the LinkedIn discussions also got a few down points.
Oh.
Yeah, so people could choose between do less, good enough, do more. Do less was a minus one, good enough was a zero, and do more was a plus one. So I could easily see what goes to the negative side and the positive side. So that's for the structure part. It was what I kind of expected.
Yeah.
Certainly the depth per topic, we've been doing a lot in just an hour of time in the last couple of weeks. And maybe it's been too much.
Sure.
Maybe fewer topics.
Yes, so that's fewer that topics, more depth more, per topic. Yeah. But I still want to be able to actually bring the whole news. I don't want to do – I'll come back to this at the end, yeah, with some personal notes from people that gave that. So to the technologies part
– come on, tell me. Containers.
You are not going to like what I'm going to say.
Get lost. I don't believe you.
I'm dead serious. So again, same thing. Do less – it's good, or do more with a zero, a minus one, and a plus one. The only technology that goes in a negative is containers.
Get lost. Are you the only person that's filled in this survey or something?
No. I'm not kidding. There's about 25 people that have done the survey. The most requested is networking, so more networking, followed by hyperconvergence.
Oh, get lost. Oh, no, it's you and Gabriel that have filled it in.
No. Followed by virtualization, storage, OpenStack is on a zero, and containers is on minus.
What?
Yes, there's actually quite a couple of those people that said too much on containers, not even just right. And or add more, but too much. So
that's it. I quit the show.
No. Well, no, it's all in balance. But
it just means we need to expand upon the benefit of containers for all.
That's right. Yeah, there you go.
But
so we're going to double down on containers.
I do see the request for more networking, as none of us of the five hosts are active in the networking environment. I do see that our guests may be missing a little bit on information there. So I'll see what we can do with that. Maybe we'll need to bring in a special guest once a month, same one, or let's see what we could do there, because we're not really active in that space.
No, that's an idea. Either that or Gabriel, I mean, your company that currently pays your paycheck, they sell the odd network switch or two, don't they? Maybe it's your responsibility to...
Gabe himself is in the storage.
No, I know that.
Yeah, I believe that they may have a network appliance or two.
You want to go check that out.
They actually sell. But I can think of half a dozen of people who would be great to bring on periodically to have a discussion around what's happening in networking, especially around software-defined networking, because that space there is, you know, fairly hot right now. You know, obviously, as we see it with Docker buying Socket Plane, all the SDM plays that are in place right now, Cumulus, Open Compute Summit this week, you know, all the things that were very specific to networking, you know, things like what Facebook are doing with Wedge and some of their products. So, you know, that space right there is actually, you know, very dynamic and very interesting from a standpoint of large scale enterprise service provider, large customer type bases that are looking at that stuff. It doesn't necessarily trickle down, I would say, into the general populace, but it is a area that has a lot of ramifications going forward in terms of, you know, the shape of things to come.
Agreed. But we can't mention Docker and Socket Plane because we're not allowed to talk about containers. So, Hans, do you have any more on the feedback from the survey?
Yeah, actually, there were two open questions. So one was give us your overall feedback, and it went from just love the show, great job, to you guys have created a benchmark for technology-based podcast, which is highly overrated comment there. There's a couple of comments, and one of them, for example, was I like the format of the technical deep dive a little better. And I think this listener is hinting towards the InfoSmack deep dives we did previously. I was on one or two of them. I did like that format as well, but it doesn't really fit a product technical deep dive with the news gathering that we're trying to do. It's pretty hard to do this, to do them together in one show. We may have a solution for that in the future.
Yes, hope we do, actually. Yeah.
Yes. Other than that, so one comment that comes back a couple of times is when we start a topic on a vendor or technology, it would be good to assume there's no knowledge and give a quick intro. So a couple of those feedback things.
Oh, that's all my fault. That's good. Yeah.
No. We do it all. And then there's the fun part. What I always wanted to ask ... to one of our hosts.
Oh no.
Yeah. Well, the funny.
Hopefully, the only questions are for Mark, and he's not on the show.
The funny ones are actually for Gabe.
Oh yes.
Gabe,
dish him out.
Yeah.
Gabe, can you go and a place that's nice and quiet for you to podcast upon?
Gabe, first question for you is, what are you eating this time?
Today, nothing. But, you know, in the past, I've had shrimp etouffee, tacos. I've kind of gone on to this ultra low carb diet. So lately, I've been eating a lot of meat and vegetables.
Okay.
That sounds good, actually. That's making me starving.
We're even going to like this question better. The second one is, how much Aquanet did Gabe use in high school on his hair?
So, all right. So here's a funny one. In high school, my hair was down past my shoulders. Like, I had long Hesher hair.
We need a picture.
Yeah, I will. Yeah, trust me. I'll take a picture up. It's horrible because I look like I'm 12 with like this big, massive mane of hair. But I did not use Aquanet. I didn't use hairspray. I was more of a gel guy. And you know, I'll leave it at that.
You've got to go through a lot of gel, though, if your hair's that long. Whoa.
Most of the time, I just would, like, you know, wake up and let it go, right?
There you go, eh? Yeah.
Okay, Nigel, short question first. Docker and the whole Linux container scene compared to jails from BSD operation systems, evolution, revolution, or shameless rebranding?
You know what? I think probably a bunch of all three. I've had a lot of conversations with people that, you know, say, Solaris zones were much better and BSD jails were this and that. And why Docker now and why maybe Rocket and LXC and stuff? A mixture of all three, right? Look, at the moment, the market is just ready for it and Docker came at the right time and gave a good user experience. I reckon there is a bit of shameless rebranding in there. We all know it's all been done before, but it just wasn't the right time back then.
I think I agree with you there. It's all about timing, technology and timing. It was the same with virtualization. Virtualization has existed for 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
It took VMware at the right time to bring it to market. So, and the next question for you is more of a personal one. Well, in a good kind of way.
Oh, yeah.
How was the experience of writing a book like, knowing that you are a busy guy? How did manage to balance this work and personal life?
Do you know what? It was awful. Okay, so I used to commute to London 4 or 5 days a week, and I had 5 hours worth of commuting every one of those days. So I did use a lot of the time on the train to write the book. I got probably about 3 hours a day on the train to write the book. It took me 11 months to write the book, and it nearly, and I kid you not here, it nearly killed me, and I will not be jumping at the opportunity to do it again. I do the training videos now, right? And it's a totally different experience because you can have humor and you can add intonation to your voice and stuff. People understand when you're cracking a joke on a video. You try and crack a joke in a book, especially for a company like Cybex or Wiley. Don't get me wrong, like they're a great company, no doubt. But they have so many rules that, you can't say this and you can't say that. It was a really painful experience and it's not something I'd jump at again. And you know what? That the money, unless you're writing like Harry Potter or something, or maybe a book on Docker, I don't know. But when you write a book on storage, and there's only like about 50 people in the world that care about storage, and you're only going to sell 2 copies, there's no money in it. So, I mean, yeah, I'm glad I've done it, okay, and have my name on the front of a book and all that jazz. But wow, it was hard work, nearly killed me.
You are published. That's all that cares.
That's all that matters now, yeah.
Final question for all of us. Complete this. If you look at the world from outer space, engineers are Gabriel.
I'm so glad he asked you first. I don't even understand the question.
So if you look at the world from outer space, engineers are...
Yeah, I got nothing.
What have you got, Hans? Go on, start the ball rolling. I'm sure you'll inspire some creativity among us.
I thought, like, if you look from high up and you look at engineers, they're like ants. And it's not only from looking from far that they're little, but ants build things together. Like, an engineer on his own can't build anything. But with 20 engineers or 100 engineers, you can build pretty big things. And everything in our world has been built by the engineers. So why you look at engineers as ants from the positive side, from the workers' perspective? They build everything.
Okay. So I would say then, and this is going to be rubbish, but engineers are the clouds. I don't even know if this works, but they're like provide the rain that is the impetus for growth and for ideas and crap like that. I really probably need to cut that out because that's just horrible.
No, it's good. Get to this. My turn. Engineers are the crust of the earth. They build the foundations upon which everything else is layered upon top of.
Boom.
That was almost like scripture.
What? Well, he had 2 minutes more to think about it.
He did. You're right. I reckon he Googled
No, that
as
came
well.
To me when I was thinking about the Hulk holding a mountain above his head in the Secret
it's
Wars
Atlas.
Comic book series.
Okay, yeah. All right. So, following our listeners' feedback, maybe we should try and get onto some technical content, do you think? So, first thing on our agenda, we've got this GPL thing, okay? So, also taking listener feedback, let's just provide a little bit of context here. So, VMware are in the process of being or having a lawsuit raised against them for violation of the GPL version 2 license. Basically, the idea is that in producing the ESXi kernel, they've gone and modified a bunch of Linux code. And in doing so, the accusation is that they haven't abided by the rules outlined in the GPL, basically the improve and share license. I'm not an expert on any of it, but they reckon that VMware have been flaunting the GPL license agreement for quite a lot of years and have absolutely no intention of ever complying with it.
I don't think not having the intention to comply with it is correct, because VMware has been complying with it upon request and upon previous, I don't even know if it were lawsuits or not, but they have been opening up and sharing what was minimally legally necessary, and I think that's just what's going to happen again here.
Okay, so the article I read said that apparently they didn't have any intention of complying with it, but we must stress, I think, especially this is a legal situation, this is all accusations at the moment. You know, we don't... the picture of Gabriel's just come through. We've got to put that in the show notes. That's bizarre.
Yeah. That's 1990.
Man, that is... well, it's not today. I know that. Anyway, sorry. So to get back to it, I think I'm going to put this diagram that I'm looking at here in the show notes as well. It compares a virtualization system, like a hypervisor-based system, that uses a complete Linux kernel. It's got that on the left. And then it's got a comparison with VMware ESXi on the right. And it's got a bunch of components like the SCSI subsystem, USB drivers, network drivers, stuff like that, all in a yellow color. And anything that's in a yellow color, if I scroll down here, it says, is modified Linux code to assist with VM kernel and ESXi. So it looks like, if this is true, a bunch of the core stuff in the ESXi kernel is all modified Linux code. And I don't think that's probably going to come as a surprise to anybody. The way that drivers work and all that kind of stuff is obviously going to be borrowed from Linux. They were never going to write something from the ground up. Maybe straying away from the technical detail a little bit here. Does anybody think that the GPL and open source software and contributing and keeping things open, does anybody think it's important or have an opinion as to whether, you know, what we're worrying about here is a load of crap. I don't care about it. How does it affect me?
You know, I think there's a lot of complexity around the GPL licensing structure and framework that most people just don't commonly understand. And I will be one of those people because I think that it's a fairly sophisticated issue to deal with. And that's why it ends up in the courts. If you look at what, you know, the Software Conservancy is doing, it's, you know, it's around protection of Helwig's, you know, code base that he's uploaded into the, you know, the kernel. And then you look at the comparison within that image around, you know, there's, you know, there's a level of, well, you know, they've infringed upon the work that I've done in terms of an open source component, and they've monetized that, and they've, you know, they've captured revenue based on it. And, you know, for people that are fully on board within the open source ecosystem, that's, you know, that's completely the wrong thing, period. And so, you know, there are some, yeah, I want to say that there are aspects of, you know, dogma here where it's like, you know, well, you know, you can't do this and you can't do that based on, you know, the spirit of open source and whatnot. And, you know, it's interesting to see that they filed the lawsuits in Germany based on the laws that they have. You know, I'm not a lawyer and I don't even play one on TV. But it'll be, like I said, very interesting to see how this all shakes out over the course of time. It's not something that's going to resolve in a very quick resolution. It's probably going to be, you know, 2 to 3 years before we actually hear anything that really shakes out from this.
Agreed. Now, I know what you say about there's a lot of complexity to the GPL license, and you know what, there probably is around any kind of license, right? That kind of stuff is all legal talk, and it's as about as boring as it can get. But the onus is surely on a large corporation like VMware, who's going to have an army of lawyers and all of that kind of stuff, to get their heads around that and to play the game. It really, to me, it doesn't feel fair that a big organization like that with so many resources behind them can potentially, I'm just saying here because it's accusations at the moment, can potentially just walk all over something like that and flaunt it in, you know, in open daylight, right?
Well, it also depends on what time, what the time frame around this is. You know, they're talking about issues starting here back in 2011 even. It's taken a long time for this to actually come to light where it's actually something that people actually understand, or where a lawsuit is fired, you know, been filed. We're talking October 2011. It's taken 3 years just to get to the awareness phase We're starting to see this. And it's like, you know, at that particular aspect, it's like it may never be resolved. It may be an SCO versus, you know, another SCO type of, you know, Unix lawsuit where it's one of these things that takes 8 to 10 years to work its way through the courts, and by that time everything has changed completely already. So what's the point?
Yeah, I think the point probably is that they need to make a showcase of somebody, because apparently violations of the GPL and other similar licenses are just rampant at the moment. And if the big guys can be seen to be getting away with it, then what's stopping everybody else just flaunting it and getting away with it? It's maybe not to recoup a load of money from VMware and to try and crush them as a company. I mean, come on. Maybe it's just to make an example of them and say, you know what? You actually can't get away with stuff like this. That's the bigger picture, in my opinion, at least.
Well, it doesn't do you any good to go after some small, you know, five-man company who's doing an infringement, right? You have to make an example of the big dogs. And, you know, it's punching above your weight, and it's going into a realm where it's like, well, here's a very large company who's benefited from this. You know, let's make an example of them. That may not necessarily be the strongest case. I think these are very selective in terms of the way they want to prosecute it or the way they want to move forward with it, so that they can bring light and attention to their cause, even if they may not prevail legally.
Yeah. An important aspect probably about it is we're speaking about it right now.
Yes. Agreed.
Right.
So, shall we move on, gents? Sticking with technical stuff, all right? Intel has just announced its Xeon D processors, okay? So, quick bit of background then. As far as my understanding goes, system on a chip, yeah? So, we've got the normal cores, then we've got memory controllers, PCIe 3 controllers, apparently Ethernet controllers. Now, I don't know the answer to this. Maybe one of you two guys knows. But does that mean that we've now got 10 gig Ethernet on the die of a chip now? Pause that question for a second, just to give a little bit more background. The processor is aimed at single socket hyperscale servers, okay? Is this in response to a threat from ARM?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah?
Yeah, of course.
But with ARM still exists?
Oh, come on. Well, they're like in every mobile. I take it you're kidding there, right? Yeah, okay.
I'm trolling.
I bet.
No, but it is to prevent ARM coming harder into the data center, which they're slowly trying to with the very small blade systems. And that's where this processor is targeted at. It's the 24 or 40 blades in a single small, like, 2U box. That's the type of system this is going into. And it's also, which you glanced over it, but it is an important part that this is a single socket CPU. There's no socket to socket communication going on. What we have in the regular servers right now, in a regular server, we have multi sockets, up to eight sockets of 60 core, 16 core, CPUs to get as much power in one single system. This is not about giving as much power in one single system, but getting as much systems next to each other with a single very, very dense, low-power processor, which is exactly what ARM is supposed to do. And they're slowly getting into the server market, and Intel is not going to allow that to happen.
No, I mean, what you see here is basically something that staves off the true hyperscale players who are building, micro compute resources in the most densest way possible to provide the most, bang for their buck per, square inch of the data center.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's what they're going after. And the more items or more pieces of the puzzle within our traditional infrastructure that they can implement onto the chip itself, the fewer peripherals and the few custom IO pieces that they need to have with inside the server itself, makes it for a condensing or shrinking down of that form factor into something that, is unrecognizable to the vast majority of customers. This kind of play is probably geared towards more of at 200 to 300 different companies than it is to the general IT market itself.
Yeah.
But those guys probably buy a shed load of servers, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you look at certain companies out there, I mean, let's take some of the financials, for instance. Whoever underwrites your credit card, right? If it's JP Morgan or it's whoever it is, right? They have instances where they may have 50 to 80 to even 100,000 physical server pieces that they're leveraging within inside their data centers. That's not your standard customer. And then if you go to even some of, what we would traditionally call web scale, hyperscale customers, you can, multiply that by, orders of magnitude. So, those are the groups that are targeted for this particular type of platform. This is not something that, look at what the Open Compute Project itself is looking to target. It's not general IT. It's a very select few customers out there, but those people buy, they buy servers by the hundreds and thousands on a daily basis in some
respects.
I'm
not sure that's necessary for, and I really think there is in a regular enterprise market, there is a space, and that space is going to grow. When we speak about big data, Internet of Things, the crunching of information that is going to be done by these small blade system environment, I don't even know how they're called, but there's probably a name for it. Like those with 24 slates in a 2U rack.
Aren't they like microservers?
Or microservers. There's definitely a name for it, and I don't know what it is. But I do see a space for that in the enterprise market. There's more and more companies that are going to want to do their own big data stuff, and this is going to fit right in there.
But a lot of this boils down to customization and capability, right? So, if you look at the Facebooks and the Googles of the world, they want to be able to strongly customize their platform. They want to get the best cross-pollinization in terms of areas that they can enact in terms of how they have to write their applications and whatnot. And, Intel versus ARM architecture, there's pros and cons to each one of those, but which one gives you the greatest, breadth of offering versus which one is tailored towards a more narrow aspect, and how much more skill set is there from a programming and coding standpoint, an app development platform versus one versus the other. I would lean towards you have a much stronger and a much larger ecosystem based around Intel than you do ARM. And that's a big prime decision and motivator in terms of, you know, who wins out in the battle in the long term.
Yeah, Intel has both the x86 as their advantage.
Oh, absolutely.
And with this processor, would, against the current ARM, and who knows what comes in the future, would have more density, and with that I mean more processing power on the same tile than you can do out of an ARM. It needs a little bit more in electrical power, but it gives more CPU power back for it on the same tile. So if you have those two advantages, being the ecosystem ecosystem leader is a wrong word, but if you speak about processors in the server and market, they have the x86 advantage, which is always going to be a big one.
So can I summarize maybe the consensus from the group here that we're not about to see a data center full of Raspberry Pis yet? Actually, how would that ever work anyway? You can't take food into a data center, right? So Raspberry Pi is never going to get in there. That's bad, isn't it?
Yes, again.
Oh, dear. Rim shot. So I'm going to stray from the agenda ever so slightly. And because we're talking about hyperscale, I thought maybe it's a good segue onto HP's Cloud Line, which I understand to be HP White Box, right? They've got this joint venture going on with the guys at Foxconn. And it's HP's play into the hyperscale market, I think. They're seeing the pinch there that white box servers from Quanta, Supermicro, people like that are starting to own that market. And it looks to me, at least, like HP think they want a piece of that market. So they've come together with Foxconn. They've produced, or are, I don't think it's quite available yet, a new line of servers under the tag HP Cloud Line. But it looks to me like it's effectively a white box server from HP that I'm guessing they're going to want to wrap with a bunch of HP warranty and support and services and stuff.
I don't know, but it's going to support the Open Compute Project, which is...
That's a good thing.
Yeah, and we just spoke like 2 weeks ago about HP doing the exact same thing with white box switches. So there is a bigger trend going on at HP here, and it's kind of weird to see it happening from all angles.
You know what my question is, though? I'm not quite sure who's going to pick these up, right? So the hyperscale guys, do they really want to buy something from HP? I might be wrong, right? I'm sure it's going to have a slight markup versus a Supermicro, all right? And I know HP are going to want to wrap services and extra warranties and stuff like that with it. I don't think that the hyperscale players really want that. That they buy white box servers and they just throw away items when they break. Or is the angle that HP is starting to see white boxes creep into the more traditional data centers and are they trying to stem that tide? And I don't know that they can be successful on either of those fronts.
You know what, to your question, what do they have to lose?
Well, they've had a lot of projects recently, haven't they, where they've tried something and then had to back out and, you know...
I know, but what do they have to lose?
They have to lose credibility. Cash? I mean, they've tried this. You know, Moonshot was supposed to address this particular market. It was supposed to be competitive with the hyperscale platforms. It was supposed to be a low-power, high-density, you know, server platform they could leverage. Apparently, you know, I don't hear a whole lot about Moonshot other than HP's running their web servers on it. I'm sure they've sold plenty of it. You know, it's one of those things I just haven't dug into. And I actually think that this is actually a good move on HP's part because it allows them to kind of straddle this area between ODM, you know, and, you know, traditional OEM. And it makes them a little more relevant. You know, if you cannot beat them, join them. And that's the kind of adage that you have to apply to something like this. And so, you know, what they're going to be doing eventually is trying to get in part of that market. You know, strong partnership with Foxconn. Foxconn builds a lot of equipment for a lot of people. You know, most people don't realize how many of their storage arrays, how many of their servers, and how many of their appliances are actually built by that organization. And as such, if you're first one to market with a joint partnership with them to provide this kind of like secondary or tertiary class server platform that is geared towards this market where it's a disposable server type of market, then you know what? There's a first mover advantage for HP to be the first OEM to jump into that. So I kind of think that's a very good move on their part. It's very forward thinking versus, you know, kind of like that we're going to force everybody to buy our, you know, our servers and our platforms with all of this, you know, additional stuff on it that the hyperscale customers don't even want.
If you look at the Open Compute Summit where all the ponytails gather, you wouldn't expect an HP to show up there, which is remarkable and in a positive way.
But this year, HP, Cisco, I mean, there's a lot of companies that you would not expect to be joining the Open Compute Alliance have joined this year. Yeah. And I think part of it is the writing's on the wall. It's like we're going to have a certain number of customers that are going to want our traditional OEM offerings that we've provided with our value add and our special sauce and whatnot. And then we're going to have some other customers that we need to at least be able to be competitive in terms of being able to bid on specific contracts or specific offerings. You know, and sometimes maybe they will see the additional value that we provide to that based on the price premium versus something going straight to Quanta or going straight to Foxconn or whoever and build it themselves, right? It could very well boil down to there may be certain aspects where, you know, a tier one OEM acting as an ODM provides some value worthwhile enough for, you know, the big dogs to actually purchase it instead of thinking, you know, they can build it themselves.
I don't really want to knock them for doing it, and I'm glad that you guys are actually moderately positive about it. I know we sometimes seem to give HP a hard time on the show, but I don't know, it doesn't feel very HP, if I can put it that way. And I doubt their ability to execute here and also to stick with it. I mean, I remember thinking with the, was it Eucalyptus acquisition and, you know, the song and dance around Martin Mikos and all of that. I remember thinking at the time, you don't just change HP like that. He can go in with all these bright ideas, and they've got guys with suits that have been at HP for 60 million years already, and they don't want to change. I know some people at HP do want to change, and this is a good thing. I shouldn't be knocking them for it. I don't know. Maybe I lack vision. I can't see it being pulled off.
No, but I think what you'll see here is a very special business unit focused on this particular sale. Keep in mind, they are probably not going to enact on this without a minimum of 1,000 units or more, right? So this is a very kind of specialized type of play. It's, you know, an HP is a company with 300,000 people. They can carve 40 people off to help kind of focus on just this area here and kind of go forward with it. And what is it to them if, you know, it doesn't cost them a lot to engage in this market space and maybe possibly realize a return where they didn't have one. And when you're talking about companies the size of HP or Cisco or Microsoft or EMC, you know, something that can create a new business line or a new revenue stream where you did not have one or you were not competitive in the past is they would rather invest in that than kind of, you know, throw another bunch of money at something that they've had for a long time that just kind of moves the needle very minimally.
Cool. Let's slightly change things then. So there's been some news this week about Big Switch and Open Network Linux. Apparently the Open Networks Linux platform, if it's even to be called that, has been accepted as the reference network operating system for Open Compute Platform, yeah?
Next to the existing Cumulus and Pika 8. But I'm not that deep in it either. I just saw it. And it's all in that realm of the Open Compute Summit. There's going to be a lot of news coming out of that summit. But apparently, it's now the third official operating system for switches.
Ah, right. Okay. So alongside Cumulus and Pika
8. Yes, alongside Cumulus and Pika 8, who were the first two operating systems for those white box switches, you now Open Network Linux, that is a big work from Big Switch, is also accepted as a standard operating system within the Open Compute project.
Fair play. Hey, Gabriel, and I'm more than happy to cut this out if you don't like it, but I've heard you rain on Linux as a generic networking platform and say it's never going to work and it's a load of tosh.
No, I mean, I think that, you know, I'm not a network guy at heart, and I try to stay abreast of some of it, but there's just so much going on there, and there's so much, it's you have open daylight, you have open flow, you have all of these different platforms. I cannot talk authoritatively in terms of which one of these different competing open software defined networking plays. And then you have ACI, and then you have NSX and everything else. It muddies the water so completely that it's very difficult to actually, unless you've spent the vast majority or a good portion of your networking realm, to really comment authoritatively on it. You know, I see a lot of different people moving in this space. I see probably way more. And we always thought storage got kind of like, you know, bogged down with a number of companies and startups in there. You know, take storage and multiply it by 5, and that's what the SDN market looks like. Because there are a lot of people out there right now that are really sharp, that have all kind of cut their teeth on, you know, the main switch manufacturers, think, I can do this better, I can go out and do this. And there are a lot of, like, you know, small startups that have gotten $2 and $3 million, and they're trying to come to market play with something that's, you know, the bigger, better mousetrap, or something that is software defined networking in the scope that, you know, we can kind of move a lot of these things away. And really, it's just kind of this big free for all. And I think
you're right. If you look at what we've seen in the last 5 years in storage, it's kind of the same thing we see happening now in networking. But you know what? We're not even done in storage, and they're still fighting left and right, and they're still most of them are still alive. The ones that started 4 or 5 years ago, there's not a lot that disappeared. So, you know what? There's probably a lot of good things to come from the networking part. The only difference with the networking part is that they need more standards than we need in storage to differentiate from each other.
It's bigger, it's messier, and it's in more flux.
When I think of 7 layers, I think of DIP.
You think of what?
I think of DIP. Here in the States, we have a 7-layer DIP. It's something you can buy at the store.
Oh,
it's,
right.
It's something you take to a party, right? It's like this beans and sour cream and guacamole and all these different pieces in it. That's the 7 layers I tend to focus on instead of the OSI
model. It sounds a hell of a lot better than the OSI model. I'll give you that. Okay, well, let's switch on to storage for a little bit then. So XIO, they've come to market with a new product, or a new range of products, actually, the ISE 800 range. Gen 3 XIO architecture, and it's shouting about one of your favorite topics, Gabriel, SPC1 numbers. Apparently, it's got the best dollar per SPC1 IO at the moment, and they reckon it maintains 100% of performance at 100% capacity. So it's an all-flash-based system, and they're shouting that, you know what, it's killed it with SPC1 on a dollar per SPC1 IO perspective, and it flies like the wind, even when it's really full. Sounds okay.
Yeah, sure.
You know what? I'm going to take you to task on this.
You know, I'm going to recuse myself from this one because they're technically a direct competitor.
Yeah.
But it's probably not a good thing for me to comment on. Put it that way. Not a good thing for me to comment on.
It's okay, Gabriel. I mean, I know the people. I haven't really read into the details of this announcement. But you know what? We've commented on SPC1 2 weeks ago when HTS came out with that Dragster. I'm not going to comment on SPC1 benchmarks. However, they are not focusing on the Dragster numbers, but on the cost numbers.
Yes.
Which was it's good that we bring that up, because I had the same argument this week with our good friend data center dude Nick Howell from NetApp, because they also had that before HDS, a big one with the EF, what was it, 760 or something?
Oh, the NetApp one.
Yes.
Yes.
They also had and I was giving him some beef on SPC1, blah, blah, blah. And then he actually showed me the press release. He said, you know what, we didn't even speak about the Dragster, but we spoke about the dollar value. And my biggest comment there is that we don't speak about that enough. We don't speak about everything else in those SPC1 benchmarks, because the benchmark of SPC1 and SPC2 is about a lot more than just the Dragster chart. So I'd love to see more details from all the vendors or on the complete set, because usually it's like, well, pay $10,000 and you'll get the papers, right? On the XIO part, good on them. Yet another contester in the all-flash area. We're down to 15 or 20 now. Down or up to 15 or 20 competitors in the all-flash area. You know what? It gets sometimes feisty when you hear them talking about each other, but it's a market that is growing, and it's necessary.
Hey, but that is way too many players in that market, though, right? 15 to 20, that's not sustainable.
No, there's a couple that are going to disappear either.
A couple? I think more.
Well, you know what? It's not always necessary to become the biggest or the new NetApp to stay alive for 10, 15 years. I mean, if you can stay healthy, it's also okay to keep within 1,000 or 2,000 customers.
Yeah. Really? I mean, yeah, I guess if you're happy being like almost last in the race then. But I mean, aside from...
Well, it's not always a race of being the biggest. Sometimes it's just a race of having a good sustainable business. And a good sustainable business doesn't have to be, I'm the biggest in the market.
I'm just trying to think, if you take the storage market, who's been around for 15 years that hasn't been acquired that isn't as big as NetApp? There really aren't very many.
No, most get acquired.
Yeah.
Or they go bankrupt after 10 years.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. Hey, speaking of the number of players that we've got in that market then, how long do you think before proper winners and losers are chosen? You know, are we talking within 12 months, within 24 months, or do we think there's a good 5 years before we really start seeing people fall by the wayside?
I think you're going to see companies just disappear from the radar.
But how soon do you think? Oh, mm-hmm. Okay. How soon?
Some of them soon, some of them later, and then in the end it's just about picking up leftovers.
Well, that was our last piece of tech news for this week, so let's move quickly on to some business news. Really sad, I think, here. I was gutted. GigaOm has folded. Yeah. You know what? I was quite a fan. I liked a lot of the people that they had doing stuff for them, and I kind of respected the pieces that they put out there. To me, they had a different feel to some of their competitors, let's say. So I was gutted.
They were real people. They were the humans back into media.
I mean, you think about it, there are 200 people that got affected by this, and people that we know, Carolyn McCrory, Barb Darrow,
Christina Weil,
a whole bunch of people that,
Steve,
you know,
Chambers.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of people that not only are our friends, but actually very intelligent and spent a lot of time in the industry. Great analysts, brought a lot to the table there. Yep. And I think GigaOm, compared to some others that are out there, actually provide a lot of value, a lot more depth than just kind of the cursory regurgitation of the press release.
Yes, I totally agree.
Yeah, and unfortunately, you know, that's a hard thing to monetize. You know, they had the structure conference, which there's a whole bunch of, you know, confusion about what happened to that, because obviously people paid for tickets and, you know, it looks like it's not going to happen. You know, I was a long time listener. I've listened to all of the structure podcasts. They're great shows. And, you know, I think there's a lot of value in that. And, you know, I wasn't paying for the GigaOm research analyst pieces, but, you know, there were probably a couple in there that I probably would have, you know, if it was more relevant to what I was doing, because there was some good work being done there. And it's really kind of a shame, you know. And, you know, obviously other tech news outlets, other tech journalism outlets, you know, there's a little bit of shade and fruit involved here. They're like, well, you know, I'm like, you know, you better look at what happened here, because, you know, that model from a monetization standpoint is not one that's long for this world. And, you know, it is very hard to make money and just by producing content. And those traditional marketing concepts of eyeballs and getting people to look at your site and clicks and whatnot, they're just not enough to pay the bills anymore.
Yeah. The problem is that this is not about eyeballs. This is about value content. And advertisers don't pay for value. They pay for eyeballs. And that's the horrible part. And it's It's sad. Giga Ohm is Giga Gun, and this hashtag is credit to Steve Chambers.
Yeah, that was a good hashtag, actually. Moving on then. Simplivity. Wow. So, hyperconverged company just raised $175 million in a Series D round at a valuation of over $1 billion. And you know what? That's like less than 2 years since general availability of the OmniCube product, I think. Wow.
Yeah, it's GA was April 1st, 2013.
Yep.
I know, because that was my first day there. But April Fool's.
Hey.
But, you know, I mean, put it this way. I think when I joined the company, you know, me and a couple others, I cover the entire West, so I cover the 12 Western states and 12 in the four provinces of Canada, all by my lonesome there.
On your bike, yeah?
Yeah, on my bike. There were 65 people in the company. If you look at a year later, there's almost, you know, a year, it wasn't even a year later that they were at about 300. They're targeting 800 by the end of this next coming fiscal, you know, calendar year. The growth of Stratus, you know, it's very fast paced growth. And it's a testament to that space, hyperconverged infrastructure, being one that is very hot right now, and a lot of people have an interest in it. You know, tomorrow is, you know, tomorrow VCE is making their big announcement, so that's something to look out for. They're going to probably announce something around HCI, or at least kind of a next generation of a VCE, you know, product. Obviously, we have VSpecs Blue, we have EvoRail, we have Nutanix, we have other players that have just come out. You know, the Vapor.io.
Oh, please.
People, don't get me started on that one. You know, and then you have Stratoscale, which is doing a software-based approach. I mean, this space is starting to get crowded very quickly. It's primarily because there's a lot of, you know, a lot of belief in that basic message. Now, it is a specific area and certain type of customer and certain type of workloads that is best targeted towards. And I think that that marketplace is going to kind of shake out over here the next couple, you know, I would say next 24 months will be very interesting in terms of what hyperconverged infrastructure looks like, you know, in terms of Nutanix pursuing an IPO possibly this year and going forward. If Simplivity has the ability to do it this year or the following year, then you have some of the other down market players like Pivot3 and Scale, whether or not they can actually get to that particular layer. You know, at some point, these companies that are taking all of these massive amounts of dollars, and it's not just hyperconverged, it's also storage and some others as well, there's going to have to be an exit plan for the VCs. I'll be curious to see what that looks like.
Well, I do see a couple
can actually
of
sustain it, right?
I do see a couple of possible acquisitions, because HP is going to do an acquisition at a certain point when they find out that it's just not going to happen with left hand. Dell has nothing except from some partnerships. They're probably going to want to play. I think Cisco is going to want to play it at a certain point. So I see at least 3 to 4 possible acquisitions, maybe from the smaller ones, not necessarily a Simplivity or a Nutanix. They could probably go IPO first, but maybe a couple of the smaller ones can get acquired when one of the biggers want to make a move. What I found interesting in the press release of the funding, and it's marketing, of course, but it was a nice way, is that the leader of the funding round was their first customer. It's a nice way if you can actually say that in your funding round, that you're one of your first customers that had two or three different sites across the world, and that's actually where Simplivity's unique selling point is. As soon as you have multiple data centers, you see the measure coming, and that customer said, it's done so much for us, let us lead the next round. And then picking up 175 million, is it's a nice round, and congratulations.
Yeah, they took 150 million from one customer that they'd worked with. I don't know if that was one of the first customers, because I was there pretty early on. And Waypoint,
is this Waypoint Capital? Yeah,
yeah, it's Waypoint Capital, based out of Switzerland, right? And, you know, relatively large organization. You know, there's a great video, right? It's like, you know, 3 minutes you're watching. It's like, it really lays it down. It's very concise. It kind of talks about, you know, the reasoning why they went this model. They had four data centers. They collapsed it all down into this 11 OmniCube solution that Simplivity provided. And it really streamlined their IT. And that makes a lot of sense. for a customer who, you know, apparently they have a lot of money, but they don't have a very large IT organization. And that makes, that's the perfect customer, not necessarily having a lot of money, but the perfect customer is the organization that does not have a lot of IT budget and a lot of IT personnel on hand, where hyperconvergence can collapse the complexity of all those disparate products into something that's very point-click based. And you can run your organization or your infrastructure on this commodity-based cube, you know, atomic building block for the data center type of model. Now, as we get into much more larger organizations, more robust, more diversity of workloads, less and less virtualization, hyperconvergence doesn't have a play there at all. And that's where we start to see some of the rack scale convergence platforms. And that's where things like vBlock and FlexPod and some of the other things that are coming out are a much stronger play. So, you know, I don't believe, and this is probably something that's come to me over the last, I would say, 2 years of working in the space, that hyperconvergence is going to take over the data center. It's definitely going to take over certain workloads and certain customers, certain sizes of customers. But we're still going to have to deal with what we consider the traditional IT infrastructure and breaking down the silos, which are in many organizations impenetrable.
It's just not going away, is it?
No, it's not. It is, you know, I have a blog post queued up that I'm going to actually probably put out at some point or another where, you know, it's like the cultural aspects of IT organizations of all sizes can trump technology, efficiency, and cost any day of the week, right? Because those as much as I would like to be able to walk and say, hey, you know what, let's all be friends and work together, the reality is that that is so much easier said than done. It's not even funny. Yeah. It doesn't matter if your technology can streamline and flatten everything and the CFO is totally bought off on it. The reality is you need to be able to implement it within your organization. And if everybody revolts because they're all protective of their jobs, then it's just not going to happen.
Yeah. Side note here, I'm doing dozens of interviews lately. And how many times that they have asked me, how well do you know ITIL and TOGAF? And I'm like, nah, that's not going to happen.
Yeah. So just two more things on the agenda. Hans, I'm going to ask you a question before I pitch them. What was the listener feedback on the length of the show? Too long, too short, just right?
That was actually, it was good. So 1 hour show is good.
Okay, well, let's just rattle off the last two things on the agenda. So this one, I didn't know how to take this. Vapor.io, okay, coming out of stealth to provide the industry's first hyper-collapsed data center. And they were talking about things like the vapor chamber and all of this, like Vapor.io, hyper-collapsing data centers, vapor chambers. To be honest, at first, I wondered if it was like one of those wind-up sites that was just like a joke.
I thought it was a joke too.
Yeah.
I thought it was a Onion article.
Yeah, yes. That's exactly it, yeah. But it looks real. I don't really have anything else to say on it at the moment because I didn't really read the article because I thought, now, this isn't for real, but apparently it is. So I'll look into this week. And if there's, I think, anything worth mentioning, maybe we'll slot it into next week's show. But, yeah, Vapor.io coming out of stealth and collapsing data centers. What's that all about? I mean,
I'm going to say it up front. Not interested. Not interested. If you call your company Vapor.io and your tagline is the hyper-collapsed data center, I'm not even reading.
Yeah, I mean, who came up with those names?
You know what? Well, it's the second or the third time in a couple of weeks that we hear a new company coming out of stealth with a ridiculous name. I think someone in the valley has a deck of cards with and that comes out of some drunk game where they wrote down the worst names to call your company, and he's selling those cards.
It's taking buzzwords and creating press releases out of the buzzwords and not actually kind of thinking about the ecosystem as a whole and what would resonate in terms of, you know, your message. And there's so many organizations out there today who are just like, you know, we just need to do something that differentiates us. Everybody else hyperconverged. Well, we're going to hyper collapse. And I'm like, you know, just be straight with what you're trying to do. Don't try to reinvent words and kind of, you know, create a plan that kind of goes to market and understands or at least imparts what you're trying to do. When I say hyper-collapse the data center, I have no idea what the hell that means.
Even forget about the buzzwords. forget the buzzwords, calling your company Vapor.io. That's criminal.
Well, I thought, you know, I mean, I thought it might have been, you know, maybe they sell those e-cigarettes or something.
It's definitely going to be vaporware.
Yeah, well, let's switch on to our last topic, because we are running a bit long. Hans, I cannot believe you've put this at the very bottom. I've only noticed you put it at the very bottom of the agenda. So Docker acquires Socketplane, and I put this out, I think, the back end of last week, that I reckon this could turn out to be the acquisition of 2015. Now, I know we're like, what are we, the middle of March right now? But I can see this being huge for the container ecosystem, obviously in particular Docker. But I mean, as far as Docker goes, networking was definitely, it's...
So tell me what's happening, Nigel. What is Socketplane? What did Docker just acquire?
Because
I didn't even hear it.
Oh, dear me, you're looking in the wrong places. So Docker's weak point is networking, really, at the moment. It doesn't scale from a networking perspective.
Oh, really?
Really, it doesn't, yeah. So they needed something to plug that, right? And there's kind of an ecosystem growing around it. There's a bunch of other products out there, flannel, weave, stuff like that. But it's very difficult to have a conversation about Docker at scale these days without somebody throwing Socketplane into the question. These are, I mean, they're only like 6 months old as a company, and the technology that they've got isn't even 1.0 yet. I think it's still like a preview technology, but it's basically software-defined networking for Docker. So it's based on OpenVSwitch, which my limited understanding of networking, what have you, I do believe is a very good product. And it basically allows you to create VXLAN tunnels between Docker hosts so that you can have kind of a single network with all of your containers on that single network. I mean, you can have more than one network, right? But it's scalable networking for Docker, and that was a real weak point. So I think if they pull it off, integrating it well, and it is already fairly well integrated into Docker, because I've looked at some of the technical preview stuff just a few weeks ago, they could be onto something here.
To plug our good friends over at the Cloudcast, episode 178 has kind of a good...
Is this with John... Is it John Willis? Is he on there?
Yeah, John Willis is on
there. I listened to that.
Bacha Galupa, yeah.
That is excellent.
One day. Great guy. Yeah, no, it's really... It's worth listening to. It's a very compelling discussion because it can let you dig a little bit deeper into what they're really trying to do, right?
Okay, so let's
and,
put that
you
link
know, John
the
and... Yeah, John and those guys going in there and kind of having a really good discussion with Aaron and Brian, who run Cloudcast. You know, if you want to dive a little bit deeper into that, we'll throw our good friends over there a plug.
Yeah, definitely. We'll put that in the show notes. Absolutely. That was an excellent episode. And in fact, you know what? As far as podcasts go, I mean, those guys have Nick Weaver on quite a lot.
Yep.
I mean, he's just top table in my opinion. He's very good.
Yeah.
Right, anything for anything else, gents?
Good to go.
All right, then, let's go.